Hello and welcome to the Peter A. Allard School of Law History Project. My name is Danielle Wint and I'm the History Project Student Coordinator. Today, July 13th, 2018, I'm interviewing Donna Lynn McLean of the class of 1993. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Danielle. I'm really happy to be here.
So just to start off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, okay, sure. Well, it's almost 25 years since I graduated from Allard Hall, which was known as UBC Law School at the time, as you know. And I'm currently living in Switzerland, where I've been for the last 20 years. I'm not working in law. I'm working as a landscape and conservation photographer specializing in alpine and polar regions, where I take photos of the landscape as a result of changing nature due to climate change and global warming. I exhibit my photos and I also talk about what I see in the field as a photographer. I talk to schools, I speak to forums and so on. I still come back to Canada occasionally, and I have my first exhibition showing in Vancouver in October 2018. Wow. So it's a pretty full-on exciting life, and that's where I'm at right now.
Could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up?
I grew up in Burnaby, and I grew up in a very middle-class family. I was raised by my mother. My father passed away when I was 3 years old. So I grew up in South Burnaby and had just a very simple middle-class life growing up there. I had no family members in the West Coast. My family was in Manitoba, and that's where my mother and I moved from Manitoba after my father passed away. So it was just the two of us living in BC. We had no family members that were practicing law. I don't even know where the idea to go to law school came from, quite frankly. And when I think about it in retrospect, I remember watching LA Law, and that was way before your time.
Oh, wow.
But LA Law was the law show in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And I really loved watching that show. And I was also very inspired. I'm quite an activist. I have an activist mentality, and I'm always wanting to get involved in causes that I feel very deeply about. So I think that's sort of how I ended up at law school. But yeah, I'm a Burnaby girl at heart, I think.
So do you recall any of your first impressions from your time at law school?
Oh, absolutely. I can recall very clearly the first day of law school where the incoming class, we all convened in the auditorium room 101, and it was, of course, the old law school. Mm-hmm. So it was the big auditorium on the ground floor. And Dean Curtis, former Dean Curtis, I think, who passed away in 2005, but he would often address the incoming class. And he stood up at the podium, and he told us all to look to our left and look to our right, because those people sitting next to you will potentially become long friends. And that was huge for me, you know, looking around at this class. We were an incoming class of 200 people.
Yeah.
And as I looked around to not just the people to my left and my right, but all of those people in that room, that, you know, some of those people would become lifelong friends, was quite an impression. And I was so excited. I really, really wanted to go to law school, and I worked very hard, and I actually worked very hard for 8 years to get there. And so for me, it was a memorable occasion, and
yeah.
I was really proud.
Well, it's funny because on our first day of orientation last September, Dean DeVern actually said the exact same thing to us. She said, look to your left, look to your right. These could be your lifelong friends, and, you know, really start to get to know these people because they're going to be in your life forever.
Well, and it's true, because 25 years later, I still have some of my closest friends are people that I met in law school. So it's absolutely true. So it was very memorable for me.
So kind of on that note, do you have any memories of interactions with specific professors or classmates that stick out in your mind?
You know, I'm a tribe person. I love to have a tribe. They say it takes a village, right? Not just a village to raise children, but it takes a village to succeed in anything in life. And I think it's really important to have your tribe, whoever that is, whether it's law school, faculty, or classmates. And when I was in law school, it was an amazing time for me because it was really intense. As you know, you're a faculty where you stay together for 3 years, and those friendships that you develop are so, they're really strong bonds, and it's a very intense intense time. So I was involved in, I was on the articling committee, I was on the graduation committee, I was on the yearbook committee, I was involved in the UBC UVic MOOT, which was an amazing experience because that in itself was incredibly intense. And our two advisors were Bob Diebold, Professor Diebold, and Professor Barry Slutsky. And we worked very closely with these two professors so that they became friends. I mean, we would go out for dinners with them, we would go out for drinks with them because we were constantly preparing for this MOOT. And the year that I did it was 1992, and that was the 10th year anniversary of the UBC UVic MOOT, and UBC had never lost. So what was riding on us was huge.
Yeah, some high stakes there.
High stakes,
yeah.
And we won.
It was
really successful, and I still am in contact with some of my teammates from the MOOT. So it was a really memorable time. I was actively involved in a variety of things. I have amazing memories from that time.
You just mentioned that you were involved in the MOOT. Were there any other traditions that you participated in during your time at law school? Things like law review or the trike race or anything like that?
No, I was not so involved. I don't think I'm at all talented in any way, shape, or form. So law review, I was a spectator and in the audience cheering on my classmates. No, I didn't do any of those traditions. You know, I was on these various different committees. That was where my interest lied.
So I read that during your summers of law school, you piloted small planes and worked in open pit gold mines in Dawson City, Yukon. So could you speak a little bit to how these unique experiences have impacted you?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, let me tell you why I was there. I grew up, as I said, in a single parent family. And so when I wanted to go to law school, and even before getting to law school, I had to finance my own education. And I ended up in my undergrad, in the very early years of my undergrad, in the Yukon. I fell upon a chance and I ended up there, and I ended up getting a job in a gold mine because there were so many employment opportunities there in the late 70s, early 80s that people were hiring women and men to do the same job and training us. So I found myself there in the early 80s getting a job running a piece of heavy equipment. I was running a front end loader. I didn't even have my driver's license at the time, but there were more jobs than there were people. So I found somebody that was willing to train me. And that's what I did every summer. And I made so much money that I could come back to Vancouver and continue on with my studies. And I knew that even in my undergrad that I wanted to go to law school. So I had to focus 100% on my studies to get the marks that I needed to get. I determined that I couldn't really afford to work during the year in terms of time management because I needed to focus on my marks. And that's what I did. And so for me, going to the Yukon every summer was a way to earn money. But at the same time, it was developing myself, my character. It was developing my relationship to nature because that, you know, I mean, the Yukon at that time was 25,000 people lived in the Yukon, and most of them lived in Whitehorse. So in Dawson City, you know, there were in the summer a few thousand people.
Wow.
And in the winter, 200. So it was in a really interesting time of my life that was very important in terms of forming who I am as a person and being a conservation-minded and very conscientious about nature. And at the same time, understanding the value of money and how hard I had to work to get it. And it allowed me freedom. It allowed me freedom to pursue my education. It provided me with freedom to do everything, to travel, to all of the things that I did in my life. You know, I think in the Yukon for almost close to two decades, going back every summer. And it just provided me with amazing opportunities. That's, you know, it's always will have a place in my heart for Dawson City. I still have friends there. I was there a few years ago. I took my family.
Wow. Do you think any of your time up there in the Yukon and kind of those environments maybe inspired your interest in photography in the similar landscapes?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Because I grew up in Burnaby, and you know, I'm not a city girl per se from Vancouver, but Burnaby is a suburb of Vancouver. It's an urban landscape. It's not a rural landscape. So I didn't really have that much exposure to wild, raw nature like I did in the Yukon. But I was there for, you know, almost two decades during my formative years and as a young adult. And absolutely, there's no question that it inspired me in terms of having a very intimate relationship with nature.
Wow. So after graduating from law school in 1993, you moved to Paris to study art and history. Could you speak a little bit about what motivated this transition away from the field of law?
When I graduated law school, first off, I clerked at Supreme Court of BC for 10 months. And while I was there, most of my friends were articling at firms. And what I could see was that I had been hired to go to a firm directly after my clerking, but I was never really sure that I wanted to practice law. Even when I went into law school, I was never really sure that I was going to do the traditional route of practicing law. I knew that as my, you know, I was very much an activist. I never saw myself practicing law in the traditional sense, but I still didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. So I took the time out in between clerking and going to the law firm that had hired me, which was the largest law firm in Western Canada at the time. And I figured they had enough articling students that they would let me go. And the Law Society governs articling students, so I had to have permission from the articling student to take that time off. And I thought, well, I'll go to Paris and study, because I had always had this innate connection. I have no idea why, but I wanted to go to Paris. I felt this pull to go to Paris, and I thought it would be a good opportunity to improve my French, because, you know, as a country with two official languages, I thought, you know, I could always improve my French, and that might improve my career choice, whatever that might be. So I basically, at that time, moved to Paris, applied to the Sorbonne. I studied for for two semesters, taking a very interesting program that was French language, but also art history and culture. And that just opened my eyes to the whole creative side of my brain. You know, I had spent the time in law school focusing on the academic interest that I had and the intellectual side of my brain, and Paris opened up a whole creative life for me. And then it was a question of reconciling the two. That was the big question. What was I going to do? How was I going to show up? Was I going to practice law?
So after your studies in Paris, you returned to Vancouver to open a soft furnishings and bedding factory. Could you speak a little bit about what the greatest challenges and what the greatest rewards were of starting your own business, and kind of what inspired this career move?
Sure. Well, when I was living in Paris, I lived in a little tiny studio apartment that I sublet from a friend. And it was so tiny. The kitchen was in the bathroom. It was like the kitchen sink was right next to the toilet. It was so small. Only in Paris would you find something like that. So I wanted to make it a little bit more cozy, and I started making soft furnishings and draperies. And I used to sew. I taught myself how to sew when I was young. And the next thing I knew, I was selling cushions and soft furnishings and making things for friends. So when I moved back to Vancouver to finish off my articles, which I had, you know, been hired in second year, and this was already 3 years later, I decided at that point that I would finish off my articles, and then I would leave, and I would set up this business. So I planned the whole thing. I decided a name. I registered it with the business registry in Victoria. It was called Objects of Desire Designs. I was going to be making cushions and soft furnishings for the home. And that's what I did. I finished off my articles in 6 months. I gave notice, and I started the business that had already been registered. I started it off at home, and within months I was in a factory in Gastown where I had a few sewers that I had hired to do all of the production. And it grew really, really fast, because I was very focused. I have an entrepreneur mind. I have since I was a child, and I was just very committed to what I was doing. So I grew it, and the challenges were that there were never enough hours in a day, because I wore many hats in the business. I was the designer, I was the marketer, I was the administration, I was the janitor. You know, I did everything but the cutting and the sewing. I had cutters and sewers, and I had a part-time bookkeeper. But it was a really incredible experience just in terms of running a business, and it was quite successful in the end. I sent out press kits to various magazines all across the country and locally, and I was covered in everything from business in Vancouver to the Georgia Strait to Canadian House and Home. I did some private contracts as well. I sold my products wholesale to retail stores across the country, but I also did some private jobs. And the biggest, most inspiring and exciting project I did was Linda Meinhart's chateau. Linda Meinhart had a food store in Vancouver, and she had a chateau in France that was a bed and breakfast, like a cooking school. And I approached her to do the soft furnishings and the the chateau when she first opened it, and I ended up doing the entire chateau wow. with soft furnishings, and then I went to stay there for a week, and that was really exciting. So, I mean, it's a long story, but just to sum it up, you know, I had it for 6 years, and I ended up selling it to a woman that had, she's an interior designer, and she wanted to expand her business. So she bought it just before I moved to Switzerland and is still running it. And I still am in contact with her and see her occasionally when I'm in Vancouver. So it was a success story for a short period of time and really fulfilled a very passionate creative side of myself. And also I was able to utilize my legal mind because, you know, I drafted my contract of sale and I was able to create contracts with different companies that I buy my fabrics from. I am organized to have certain discounts, bulk discounts, and so forth. So it was exciting. But ultimately, I sold it because I moved to Switzerland for love.
Mm-hmm. You briefly mentioned that you were able to utilize your legal education when you were running this business. Could you speak a little bit about how your legal education has kind of, you've been able to carry on using it, I guess, through other aspects of your life and maybe in other business endeavors?
Absolutely. I have to say that there is not a moment that I regret going to law school. It was a highlight of my life. I value the education extremely. It assists me daily, just in terms of my cognitive abilities, you know, my research skills. I have impeccable research skills, as anybody that goes through law school for 3 years does, as you know yourself. I also invest in real estate. Real estate is something that I've been investing in 20 years, and it provides me with financial freedom now to pursue a career in photography. So with that, I'm able to oversee all of the contracts, you know, for every purchase, for everything that I'm involved in with lawyers or with property managers, because I have property managers looking after my properties in certain countries. I invest in Switzerland, Germany, and in Canada. So this is something that I don't, you know, I have lawyers that I use to finalize the sale, but I'm able to review the contracts and I'm able to review all of the legal documents that I need to myself. I'm also using it a little bit in a project that I'm currently working in with a scientist and a photography colleague from Norway. He's writing a book on the on polar bears and the culling of polar bears worldwide, because I'm not sure if you know this, polar bears are legally culled in three countries, the harvested, as really? They call it. Yeah, you're legally allowed to kill polar bears in three countries worldwide: Greenland, the United States, and Canada.
It's
shocking.
Very surprising to me.
It's very surprising. It was very surprising to me as well. And so I've been working with him on, he was wanting to get some research from Nunavut and the Northwest Territories with respect to the numbers of the harvest. And he was being blocked at every turn. The government in Nunavut was not sharing the information with him, nor was the government of the Northwest Territories. So I came into the project and said that I would help him. And I basically applied under the Freedom of Information Act. And we got all of the information that he needed that they have never released to anybody before. Wow. Because they were required as a result of the statute to relinquish the information. You know, had I not been a lawyer, I might not have known to take that path. So I think it's just, you know, it gives us an ability to research. I mean, that's the thing. I don't have all of the information in my head, but I have the research skills that I acquired through my 3 years in law school, which is an intensive training ground to be able to think in a cognitive capacity that you necessarily don't acquire in other faculties or other areas of life. I use it daily, even with rearing my children, you know. it's an amazing education, whether one practices law or not. Yeah, mm-hmm. I would do it in a heartbeat.
Yeah, for sure. With all of the problem solving and kind of critical thinking skills, it's definitely really hones in those abilities. So mm-hmm. as you mentioned, you recently entered the photography industry, which has taken you to many extreme environments across the world to capture polar and alpine landscapes. And so could you just speak a little bit about what kind of sparked your interest in photography and if you have any upcoming projects that you're particularly excited about?
Sure. Well, you know, I was the hobby photographer, always the person with the camera strung around my neck, taking photographs, much to the chagrin of everybody, well, my family particularly. But I was a hobby photographer for 30 years. And 3 years ago, my life changed. My marriage ended. My mother died. even my dog died. And it was a transition for me. It was a crossroads. I was 55 years old. I had been primary caregiver for my children. My real estate investments, you know, I can pretty much do with my eyes closed. It's not like I was committing myself to a passionate endeavor. And that's when I decided that I really needed to commit myself to something that I was passionate about. And I went to photography school. Here in Switzerland, I enrolled in a full-time photography school for 1 year. I got a diploma and I up-leveled my photography skills. And I've always been interested in the landscape and nature as a result of my Yukon days. So I started photographing in the Swiss Alps. And I mean, the Alps are everywhere. The Swiss Alpine region is one of the most stunning of the world. So I would go to the Alps. I have a ski holiday home in Klosters near Davos. And I started photographing there. And what I saw was not only stunningly beautiful, but also devastating in terms of the detrimental effects of climate change and global warming. I saw scarring moraines of glaciers that were kilometers long. I spent time in an environment that should be, you know, at the height of the ski season, there was no snow. And these industries in the Alpine, you know, the Swiss Alpine regions, the ski areas are really suffering, as, you know, ski regions anywhere in the world when there's no snow,
sure.
Right? They're, mm-hmm. Economically, it's very, very difficult. So I started thinking about it really critically, like, what is going on? You know, you hear it all the time, global warming, read National Geographic magazine, you see it everywhere, but I hadn't seen it so viscerally with my own eyes. And I wanted to investigate further. So I decided to go to the Arctic. And I went to Svalbard, and I went with a team of scientists and photographers last year. And I saw the same thing. You know, I mean, I didn't have the history of seeing what had been previous, but I was with the scientists who could tell me that, you know, these glaciers had receded so much. I could see the scarring moraines. I could see a little bit of the evidence. And then listening to the stories, I mean, there are birds there in Svalbard that are on the verge of extinction. And when those, it's a whole ecosystem, as you know, when those birds are extinct, the Arctic fox is extinct because they live off these birds, and so on and so forth. And we saw bears, polar bears, swimming for 5-6 hours because they couldn't find enough ice. Last year was the record high temperatures in the Arctic, and subsequently I found out in the Antarctic. This year I'm going to Greenland, and I know already, I saw this yesterday on the news, it was on CBC, there was a glacier that calved half the size of Manhattan, or was it the size
that.
Of
yeah.
Yeah, did you see that?
I saw that, yeah, that's crazy
so,
to me.
That is crazy. And I mean, this is another indication that this is yet again a record year for global warming and for increased temperatures. So this is an area that I decided, okay, the evidence is so paramount, and it's, you know, it's so before my eyes in terms of what I'm seeing. Can't unsee it. I cannot go back and pretend that it doesn't exist. And I want to get involved. What can I do? So I decided to take what I see in the field and exhibit. I exhibit my photos. I show them as fine mm-hmm. art. So, I've had 4 shows in the last 12 months. I currently have 2 shows going on, and I'm booked until 2020. I have my first show in October, October the 12th, in the fall. So I hope you can come.
Yes, that would be amazing.
And I am now speaking. I'm speaking to schools, and I'm doing my first TEDx talk in October on Vancouver Island. And I'm basically showing my photos, and I'm talking about what I see. But I'm not just, when I go to schools, for example, I don't just leave the students immobilized with fear. I actually talk about what we can do, strategies that we can implement in our life right now, take home strategies, you know, how we can reduce our carbon footprint. Because I think it's really important to give people the skills to mobilize them to make the changes and not just leave them immobilized
definitely.
With fear, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
So this is the new trajectory of my life, and this will be my life's work because I'm completely passionate about it. I'm dedicated to it, and there's, you know, and I have a voice. We all have a voice, and some of us have a voice within the confines of our own domestic sphere. Some of us can take that voice out into our community. I have a voice that I think can be heard. You know, I have the legal training to get the research that I need to be done. I have the wherewithal to put it together, and this is something that I'm extremely passionate about. So one of the projects that I'm working on right now is It will be in January 2019. I'm creating a foundation in Switzerland. I just had a meeting with the board yesterday. I've put together a board of myself and three other individuals. One is a scientist, one is a head of a private school in the Engadine near St. Moritz, and one is my partner who I travel with and photograph with, and he comes from a marketing and tourism background. And we're putting together this foundation where we will have a summit annually, and it will be an ongoing project where we will bring together art. So next year we will show our art from the Antarctic, from the Arctic, from Greenland, and we will have a panel of speakers where we will have scientists coming to talk about. One of the scientists is a specialist for the Greenland ice sheet. Another is a glaciologist, and it's a combination where we will be, you know, bringing together visual images of what you see in the field, and we will be speaking as lay people and photographers about what we see and the impact, you know, it has for us, and also bringing in the scientific evidence. And we will be opening this to the community. So there will be workshops for students. There's a boarding school in Zuwaats. We will be opening that to all of the students in the community, having workshops for them. We will be having speaking events and bringing in the general public. We will be having fireside chats. We will be showing documentaries. There's a nearby hotel that's an art hotel, the Hotel Castel. They have a movie theater there, and they will be screening nightly. It will go on for 4 days. They will be screening the various different ecological and environmental documentaries, like James Balgon's Chasing Ice and Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth and the sequel. And, you know, I want this to become a global entity, an annual event, kind of like the WEF, you know, the World Economic Forum that goes on in different. And there's these annual events that are very big, and they bring this information to the forefront. And that's the project that I'm working on right now. And I really want it to be huge and take it out there.
That's very exciting. That's pretty incredible. Just speaking a little bit more about your photography, I have seen that all of your photos you take in color, but then kind of transform into black and white, which I thought was very interesting. Would you like to speak just a little bit about kind of the reasoning behind that and kind of what inspired you to make that decision?
Sure. I see landscape in black and white. It's very simple. I see through the light and the shadows, I see the form. So for me, it's really about the form. And I've been collecting photography for 20 years, and I collect the classic photography from the Magnum era, and that's all black and white. And I think part of that has trained my eye, but also part of it is when I go out into the landscape, I see the landscape in black and white, and I'm always looking for the light in the shadows to show the form. And so, you know, I'm always very aware of where the light will be, what the time is. I have an app on my phone that tells me, you know, where the sunrise is in relation to where I will be standing, so I can determine what time I need to be there to get the best use of the light and the shadows. And that's something that really interests me. And it's I love a lot of, you know, a lot of my colleagues, they shoot in and they show their photos in color, and I think that they're amazing and they're brilliant. But I think that my talent lies in my ability to really show in black and white and show the form through the light and the shadows.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting and unique, so I thought I would just ask you a little bit about it.
Thank you.
So just as we've kind of been discussing, you no longer reside in British Columbia and you no longer are practicing in the field of law. However, you have retained extremely close ties to the Allard School of Law at UBC. Your involvement has ranged from organizing the 20-year class reunion for the class of 1993 to hosting events abroad for international alumni to your many years of continued support for the Allard School of Law. If you could share just a little bit about what about your time at the Allard School of Law led you to continue to foster these close connections to the law school community?
Well, you know, like I said before, I think we all have times in our life that are very memorable and that we hold very close in our heart. And my time in law school was one of those times in my life. I didn't come from a background that it was a given that I would end up in law school. That was really a privileged opportunity for me, and it was transformative, just in terms of providing me with the opportunity, the cognitive opportunities and social relationships, educational, academic. So I think it's really important to give back. I mean, that's part of my philosophy of life, is I want to have a life of meaning. I want to have a life that where, you know, my legacy is that I was giving back in areas that are meaningful to me. And my time in law school is one of the highlights of my life. And I think, as I said before, you know, we have tribes, and I had my tribe in law school. I'm still in contact with many of those people. So when it was time for us to consider having a reunion, because I was so involved in law school, I was on the grad committee, I was on the articling committee, as I said, I really wanted to get involved with being on the reunion committee. And I did, and I worked very closely with, there were four of us on, one unfortunately couldn't participate so much, but you know, he was with us in spirit. And three of us were very actively engaged in organizing this. And one of the things that I spearheaded was, we had a Legal Who magazine that came out regularly in law school. Yeah. I did a 20-year later version where I got all, you know, we found 100, and out of a class of 100, and I think we were 189 graduating, we had 120 people show up for the reunion, and I had 150 people submit a questionnaire for this new 20-year later Legal Who, with an answer to 10 questions, an updated biography, a new photo, and I combined it with their old photo, and then I made some hard copies that we had in a raffle, and everybody got a disc, mm-hmm. and they could contribute some money for the cost of this, because we also established a bursary. It was really important to me to honor six of our classmates who had passed away. One classmate came as a mature student and passed away from natural causes at I think in his 70s or 80s. He was in his 60s at law school.
Oh, wow.
But the other five classmates passed away in their 40s. So they were all quite young. And so, you know, six of us from a class of 20 years graduating, that was a lot for me. And I wanted to establish a bursary in memoriam for them, named the, you know, the memorial bursary of class of 1993. And we needed $30,000 to establish a bursary in our name, as opposed to it just going in the general fund. For law school. So that's what we did. And I'm really proud of that, because every year there's a law school student that is a recipient of the class of 93 bursary, that is a memoriam to our classmates. And I think that that's a wonderful legacy that goes on for time in perpetuity. At the very last weeks, we were scrambling to get it to the $30,000 mm-hmm. limit, because otherwise it would have just gone into the general fund. So that was a really important project for me and my classmates as a whole. And I think that the reunion, you know, it was the most successful law school reunion in the history of the law school, as I heard from the Dean Bobinski was the dean at the time, Marianne Bobinski was the dean at the time, and I worked very closely with her and Jennifer Reagan and Carrie Strelaski, and they were so supportive, and it was... We had just an amazing turnout. We had contests. We had people flying in from five countries from all over the world, Singapore, yeah. Australia. I came from Switzerland, from France, from England. And it was, you know, the people that didn't show up really regretted it in the end, because we had a professional photographer. We had some video footage. I think we'll definitely be having a 30th. It was a lot of work. We worked on it nonstop for 8 months. But, you know, if you want something to be successful, you have to put in the skin. That's the only way it's going to turn out.
And I think that probably also just goes to show how connected your whole class was. If, you know, all these people were coming from across the world and everyone was filling out the questionnaires and helping with the bursary, it just goes to show kind of what a tight-knit class law school really develops, which I think is pretty incredible as well.
That's true. That's very true.
So you may have already touched on this, but was there an aspect of your 20-year reunion or the process of organizing and planning it that you really enjoyed the most?
I loved putting together the bursary. I mean, you know, the reasons behind it were very sad, but it was really important to me that we could create this bursary in memoriam of our classmates. I think that I'm really proud that we could do that and we could honor these classmates that we all knew and loved. And yeah, that I'm the most proud of that. And I'm really glad that we did it. Of course, I'm proud that it was the most successful law school reunion. I look upon that whole experience, you know, that people made the effort and made the commitment to buy a plane ticket and fly halfway across the world, or to show up from locally, but that they all, it all meant, you know, it meant so much to them. And that's, sure. I think that it's a it was a really meaningful experience. I created a Facebook page where, you know, we could all keep in touch, and it's still going. It's not so active right now, but, you know, there's still a core group of us that are still in touch. And sometimes when I'm in town, you know, people get together and we'll go out for a drink. So this is a tribe, you know, we have our tribes in life, and it's important to have our tribe. I think those people that are the most successful in life, and not just monetarily, but those that have the greatest spiritual, emotional connections, are those that have their tribe. We're human animals. We need our tribes. And law school was one for me, and it was a very important one. And still my friends from that tribe remain so today.
So you mentioned the 30-year reunion would, I guess, be upcoming in 2023. Do you think you would take on a leadership role again?
Yeah. It was a lot of work, but I can't imagine not. You know, I get involved.
Yeah.
I am the kind of person that gets involved and I take things on. And yeah, for sure.
We spoke a bit about how you've been an individual who has led a very unique and somewhat untraditional career after law school. So is there any sort of advice that you would like to pass on to law students of today?
You know, I try to live my life in terms of what I'm contributing to making this planet a better place. And I think it's important to just be cognizant of what our contributions are and always think about, you know, what are our contributions and how are we living our lives, and not just being on that treadmill of existence and chasing after ephemeral successes, whatever they might be. I think that, you know, we are all here on this planet for a purpose. We all have our intrinsic purpose that we have to discover and determine what that is for ourselves. But I can tell you that from my own experience, that our purpose in life is intrinsically linked to our passion. So if we can just sit still and meditate on that, you know, in quiet, because sometimes it's hard to get in touch with what our purpose and our passion is when there's all the external stuff going on around us.
Sure.
But we need to really be connected to that. And when we find out what it is we're really passionate about, that will guide us to our purpose. And therein we can start making contributions to the planet, to the world, to, you know, society, to nature, whatever it is, right? Within law, outside of law, it doesn't matter. Whether you continue on with the practice of law in a traditional sense or untraditional sense, or even go outside of the law, it doesn't matter. What's important is that you find your passion and you live your life with purpose. And when we're doing that, when our passion burns brighter than our fear, there are no limits.
Those are some great words to pass on to young lawyers and law students of today. So just on a slightly different note, did you have any sort of impactful mentors or individuals who kind of provided you some guidance throughout your various careers and your life in general?
You know, whenever I'm doing something, whatever it is, I always like to organize around people that are smarter than me, who know more than me. So consequently, most of my friends are smarter than me, more successful than me. They have open hearts. They all want to make a difference. And those are the people that I learn from. So I just, you know, I really want to, I'm a student of life. I want to associate with people who are where I want to be, because that's how I can up-level my life.
Wow. So just before we conclude, is there anything else that you would like to share with us today?
Well, to you personally, enjoy the ride of law school, because it will be one of the most memorable times of your life, as it was mine, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And I just want to thank you for this opportunity to share my experiences, because I'm on the second half of my life's journey, and I'm 58 years old. And I, you know, I hope that I can be leading a productive life doing what I'm doing until 100. Why not? You know, it can be done these days. And I really want to make a difference in this world. And I thank my time in law school for giving me the intellectual and cognitive abilities to pursue the dreams that I want. And with my open heart and my fearless attitude, I think that I can really aspire to achieving those goals and those dreams.
Thank you very much. And thank you so much for taking the time to share your stories about your career and about your time at the Allard School of Law. So with that, this concludes our interview with Donna Mueller of the class of 1993. Thank you very much.